George McEncrow with you this morning on Disrupt Radio. Are you watching the Cup today? Does it stop the nation? Are you even an Aussie if you've never written yourself off on Cup Day? Stay with me, George McEncrow.
On DAB+, online and on demand. The news feed you need. This is Disrupt News.
Morning. George Denekian, checking the stories that are making headlines, and it'll be a nervous wait for mortgage holders with the RBA to hold its monthly meeting in Sydney today. Economists are tipping a 0.25% rise to the cash rate. Vigil has been held in the Victorian country town of Daylesford overnight for the five victims of a horror crash on Sunday night. They've all been identified. Victoria Police hoping to interview the 66-year-old driver today. In Beijing, it's been described as a new starting point in the relationship between Australia and China. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says positive and constructive discussions were held with President Xi Jinping. The United Nations has once again called for an immediate ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. Call comes amid reports the death toll on the Strip continues to rise. And in New South Wales, the identity of the boys killed in that horrific crash in Ashcroft yesterday have been revealed. 13-year-old Braden Collier and his 14-year-old friend Kane Bell died when they were thrown from the car when it broke in two. New South Wales police are hunting for the two men who were also in the vehicle that slammed into a telegraph pole on Maxwell Avenue, but then fled the scene. That's the news for now. Back with more in half an hour.
To you by Telstra Small Business. Keeping IT human.
My family is full of punters. It's not my fault. Cup Day was a day where the family came together and placed bets. I never knew my quinella from my quadrilla, but I liked the chat. The parents would get smashed and drive us home with no seatbelts and no shits to give about our safety or theirs or the general public's. It was the 70s. Now my parents wear seatbelts and take the back streets. They've really grown. And so too has our attitude towards horse racing and animal exploitation. My son's friend is here from Germany and recently was watching the telly and saw a greyhound race. Was ist das? Are they pet racing? Are they real? What are they doing? I didn't know that greyhound racing was not a global phenomenon. It suddenly looked so very, very strange, watching a dog be raced at nighttime, wearing a number and chasing a rabbit. It took some time to convince her that, yes, this is indeed real. Last year, $29 billion, or a little over, was spent on horse racing. Yep, $29 billion. But the popularity of the event has definitely waned. Young people do not hop along to the races now in the way they once did. Only 11% of people recently surveyed said they had a high interest in the race and the race that's meant to stop a nation. More than ever, young people in particular are avoiding the event or protesting actively. The whipping of horses, tongue-tying, and the bleeding from the lungs of horses pushed to their limits. Some people object to the excessive drinking of the crowd and the violence that so often follows booze and gambling losses. Violence that all too often ends fatally and happens behind closed doors. I've never enjoyed horse racing. Women described as the hot fillies on the track and paraded around, much like animals in the ring before bets are placed. Men talking about the form of this woman or that one. Ugh, yuck. Go forth and enjoy your public holiday if you have one, but don't feel like you're missing much if you don't watch. Change has come to the event, and I suspect in years to come, people will look back on this spectacle as barbaric. I'd prefer to watch politicians in an egg and spoon race. And if they bleed from the lungs, well, that's not so bad.
This is Moolah with George McEncrow on Disrupt Radio.
Great to have your company. It is Cup Day and some of us are working. Somebody who knows a lot about how to create a good workplace and keep people healthy and ticking along is our regular and wonderful guest, Audrey McGibbon, executive coach, chartered occupational psychologist and a researcher, also a keynote speaker. Welcome, Audrey.
Thanks, George. Good to be back.
Now, tell us, how do we stop people from being overworked in all the areas?
Well, it's going to take a bit of a group effort, I suppose. There's some of it's down to the individual and some of it's down to the organisation, and some of it depends upon, I suppose, society's expectations and even the industry sector that you're in. So it is a collective responsibility. It's quite an interesting one.
I mean, I think the workaholism issue is very real, and it is one of those, I mean, I think it is as dangerous as any other addiction, but it gets so much, it's so pro-social, you know, it's so applauded and rewarded. How do you identify somebody who has a real work addiction?
You're right. I mean, it is pro-social. It's sort of a bit like the exercise addiction. It's both admired by some people in society, and it's sort of a badge of pride as well. You know, how do you spot it? Well, it can get really easily confused with things that employers value a lot, like, you know, somebody's being really committed and responsible, and they're, you know, never sort of underdone on their work effort. So there's a lot of stuff in there that you go, oh, well, that's just really good. Good work ethic, solid work. And so what you're really looking for, similar signs to signs of any addiction, you know, it's like, well, what happens when they're not getting that thing that they really are addicted to? So if someone's not working, what is their behavior like? You know, are they moody and irritable, preoccupied? Are they just thinking about their next sort of fix or hit?
Yeah.
That's coming from work.
And where does it come from? I mean, I guess, you know, it's so easy to fall into the trap of thinking that all of your value is tied up in how your career progresses or how your colleagues perceive you. Even if that's not about a bank balance, it can still be, you know, seen as very positive to have that affirmation. And I know, you know, there's sort of a understandable sort of slight depression, I guess, if you transition from working full-time. I know a lot of people talk about this when they retire, that it's a part of your identity. I certainly felt it when I had children and stopped working full-time for a period. You know, I was like, who am I? But I would never have called myself. Like, when does it go from being pathological to just part of your identity?
Such a great question. I mean, you can be really high achieving and determined and outcome focused and have a strong career identity. It doesn't mean to say that you're work addicted. I guess what shifts is when that set of sort of individual attributes, you know, perfectionism, even extroversion, is linked to work addiction, because it can often come with a sort of a desire to get validation from other people.
Yeah, right.
You can have those things and not be a work addict. So what happens and what turns you into a work addict is a little bit down to your own self-regulation, but it's also to do with, well, what is the environment that you put somebody like that into? So if you put them into a workplace culture that is essentially characterized as a place where people grind it out, they do huge hours, they've got heavy workloads, job demands are constant, relentless, then not everybody who goes into that environment will be a work addict, because they'll hold their boundaries and they might not care so much about it. They don't find it seductive. But when you put that combination of an individual with certain predispositions into an environment with certain characteristics, one where basically really hard work is the primary thing that gets rewarded and valued. You know, it might be, oh my God, what an amazing effort. George worked all weekend to deliver this paper and what a great job. It's like when that's the dominant thing that you know is associated with reward and success and progression, then that is a, you know, a petri dish where workaholism gets cooked up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, I think not everybody is born a workaholic. Like, they might be, you know, with a gambling addiction or a predisposition for alcoholism because of genetic factors and things like that. Workaholism is, I think what you're saying is, it's about where you end up dropping in whatever workplace. And it is pretty random how you end up in your particular job, especially as a graduate. And that can mean that you develop, I suppose, these tendencies.
Yeah, I mean, like other addictions, there are sort of individual temperament, biological pieces. So if you're more predisposed to anxiety or depression, or you have OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, then that is that's another risk factor for becoming a workaholic, because workaholism can often just be masking, I guess, a more serious underlying condition. So there's some things to do with the individual, some things to do with the environment, that when those two sets of things intersect, that creates kind of the workaholic. And I think it is really important, because in society, we describe people as workaholics or work addicts, as you say, often with a bit of sort of kind of, oh my God, the admiration that's there. Yeah. And managers are loath to say, oh, you know, please stop being a workaholic, because they think it's a good thing. But really, it can be problematic. Yeah.
And it can be a place for avoidance. I mean, you know, I remember getting so, I can't believe I did this, but I had, you know, little kids at home and a husband who's working extraordinary hours. And once I actually called his boss because I thought he was going to drop dead. He'd worked, he was sleeping like 3 or 4 hours a night. But it was so tricky to get, you know, any, I don't know whether he was just avoiding family life, which was really hard, 4 kids under 5, and throwing himself into his job, you know, and I guess I must have been out of my mind myself at the time and wanting him to be around a lot more. But there's lack of happiness. I think that's sort of where I knew it was problematic. You know, he wasn't happy with anything he ever did.
Using work as a proxy, and then it, you know, becomes a bit of chicken and egg. So how much of that is avoidance because of other things, and how much of it is, well, now I'm hooked into work, it's is becoming more and more pervasive in their thoughts, and it's really difficult to put it down. It, you know, without that crux or crutch, it's difficult to attend to other things. And, you know, like an addict in any other walk of life, well, the sign of it being a problem is it when it starts to interfere and stop you doing the other things that matter in life that are really important to you.
Like sleep.
like sleep, like family commitments, like family obligations. But you can't just use the work hours as the obvious characteristic, because there are lots of people who are working exceptionally hard and long and intense hours at the moment who aren't work addicts.
Yeah, right.
And differentiation is the work addict just can't stop. It's a compulsion to keep on working, even although they know that other reasonable people and other reasonable jobs, they're probably stopping. So it's stuff that's, it's not because there's a boss standing over them saying, I need this by tomorrow morning. It's kind of self-driven.
Yeah, it's a self-driven thing. Yeah. Look, wait, I'd love to ask you some more questions, particularly about what particular industries, you know, if there is an area where people get themselves into trouble. If you'd stick around, that'd be great to continue the chat shortly.